Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Eric Hall. I'm here on behalf of appellants, both defendants and interveners. My bar number is 32028. With me at council table is Jim Lyons for Douglas County, Tony Dill for the state of Colorado, and Michael Bindas for the intervener families. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about the Douglas County Choice Scholarship Program. The program offers an additional educational choice to students who have been enrolled in Douglas County public schools for at least a year. No family must participate in it, and it in no way hurts the opportunity of any student to receive a free public education. Parents can still choose any other option: traditional public schools, charter schools, contract schools, facility schools, magnet schools, homeschooling. All of those options are still available to parents. Through the Choice Program, the district offers aid to parents on a neutral basis without regard to religion. As a neutral program, it neither favors nor disfavors any private school, religious or non-religious. All schools must sign the same contract. All schools must abide by the same 12 conditions of eligibility. And one of those conditions is that all the schools that qualify must provide at least the same educational quality as the district's neighborhood and charter schools. From this academic baseline, parents may choose schools that offer something more. Some parents, for instance, might want to choose more math and science. That was the choice of the Andersons, one of the intervener families in this case. The Oakleys, another intervener family, wanted a school who could better assist their special needs child. And the Doyles chose Regis High School because they wanted a Catholic education consistent with their family's religious beliefs. The district wanted to provide this additional choice because it believes competition among schools improves the education for all. Douglas County relied on the 2004 case of Owens versus Colorado Congress of Parents, decided by the Colorado Supreme Court, which said, and I quote, "Local control of education under Article 9, Section 15 provides each district with the opportunity for experimentation, innovation, and a healthy competition for educational excellence." That is what Douglas County is trying to provide with this choice program.
Owens, Mr. Hall, may I interrupt, please?
Yes, sir.
Do I understand correctly that the decision to create this program was the school board's?
Yes.
And did the school board or the program itself or anyone associated with it solicit any of the schools that were eventually became part of the program? Did they say, why don't you apply?
No, Your Honor. The program was started as part of a task force in June 2010. The task force was a school choice task force. It had this program as one of its elements, but it had six other elements as well. It had charter schools, it had homeschooling, it had open enrollment, it had magnet schools, contract schools. All those different options were also considered by the task force. And then by November of 2010, the task force presented its preliminary recommendations to the school board. The school board then turned it over to its superintendent to do some more investigation. There's a lot of press about it. There are open public meetings. And finally, the school board on March 15th, 2011, unanimously agreed to adopt this choice program. Again, for three purposes, which are undisputed and unchallenged. One, to provide additional educational choice so that individual families can find the right education program for their individual students. That's the first. Second, so that Douglas County could get a good return on its investment. And third, again, so that through competition, all schools are made better. They want to increase the quality of schools throughout Douglas County. And again, Owens from 2004 expressly allows local districts to make this sort of choice. Owens says districts have the constitutional authority to tailor educational policy to the needs of their particular district. Owens noted that Colorado is just one of six states in our country that has an express local control provision. In addition to...
Mr. Hall, I want to inquire, hopefully briefly, as to a procedural point I'd like to clear up, and that is whether we have a final order. We had a motion for preliminary injunction, I guess two motions for preliminary injunction, and a ruling on those motions, and a ruling on a motion to dismiss, denying the motion to dismiss.
Correct.
And then at the end of the court's order granting the preliminary injunction, the court made the injunction permanent.
Correct.
Okay. Is it your position then that the court's ruling is final? That is, in essence, what the trial court did was have a trial on the merits of the case.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And your clients have had no objection to the court doing that, even though it was just a hearing on a motion for preliminary injunction.
We were not provided any notice. We had no knowledge that the court was going to do that until we read the order that came out that August.
But I saw nothing in the record complaining about a lack of opportunity after the order was entered to present additional evidence or anything like that.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, so there's no dispute here, at least from your perspective, that we have a final order finally disposing of all the claims in the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and just so counsel is aware, I'm going to ask for appellee's position on that particular issue as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to touch further on the statutory authority, because I believe Owens and a whole line of cases dealing with Article 9, Section 15, the local control provision, establish beyond doubt the constitutional authority for Douglas County to create this program. But the statutory authority also comes in the Finance Act. Again, Section 104.1A of the Finance Act has funds, Finance Act funds, flow to local districts. And that's consistent with, again, Colorado's a system of local control. And then the section explicitly provides under 104.1A that the amounts and purposes for which such Finance Act monies are budgeted and expended shall be in the discretion of the district. And so again, the district has the statutory authority to create this program and take the monies that it receives and spend them in the way that it did.
Mr. Hall?
Yes.
Is there anything in 104 that confers standing on private citizens?
No, Your Honor. There is nothing. And the trial court didn't even cite anything. The trial court found standing, again, we believe incorrectly, but there is no citizen standing provision. To the contrary, actually, and we cited the provisions of the Finance Act statute that actually confers a regulatory scheme whereby the state, through the Colorado Department of Education, supervises how Finance Act monies are properly distributed or not. And that's, again, fully briefed in the state's brief. But there's nothing that would give the parents or the taxpayers a standing to bring a Finance Act claim. Parents object to the program because they object to the fact that private and religious schools can participate. They assert public funds can't be spent in this way, but again, plaintiffs are wrong as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. The essential holding of Americans United, again, the Colorado Supreme Court case from 1982, is that public funds can be spent at private and religious schools by means of a neutral program of private choice.
Pardon me, Mr. Hall, if I may, please.
Yes.
Didn't Americans United expressly suggest that the outcome might be different if there were elementary and secondary schools involved as opposed to institutions of higher education?
Yes, but the Tenth Circuit in Colorado Christian University versus Weaver explains at some length that those parts of Americans United are now discarded doctrine.
Well, as I read Weaver, it appears to be focused at the concept of pervasive sectarian analysis, and that is a notion that the Supreme Court plurality in Mitchell said we shouldn't be using anymore. But as you know, Justice O'Connor, in her concurring opinion, looked at it somewhat differently. And so that takes me to my next question. Lemon was a school funding case. And Lemon also talked about the concerns about younger kids and the influence of religious, overtly religious education on younger kids being inconsistent with what we want to do with public monies. And Mitchell doesn't pretend to overrule Lemon. So where are we with that?
Your Honor, where we are is that the two places in Americans United that talk about this K-12 issue, they both talk about the risks of indoctrination to younger students. And Weaver is directly on point in discussing at some length why any sort of indoctrination analysis is not only discarded doctrine, but unconstitutional. Again, Weaver goes on and says there are two reasons why any sort of indoctrination analysis it violates the First Amendment. The first is it excessively entangles the courts in an investigation about how religious a school is. And one of the holdings from Weaver is that you cannot, that courts, this is a quote, courts should refrain from trolling through the religious beliefs of a school. And that's precisely what the trial court did in this case. The trial court is trolling through the religious beliefs writ large.
Well, again, if I may, I certainly understand the point, and I think part of the emphasis was that, well, if you look for religious differences among different religious beliefs, then you get into trouble. But going again to Justice O'Connor's concurring opinion, when she seems to focus on money, the purpose that the money is used, as opposed to the nature of the institutions, isn't what the trial court doing simply saying that the money is used for these purposes?
It's undisputed. The record is undisputed. I mean, the trial court, again, stated that the money in this case under the choice program is being used to aid the student and not being used in aid of the institutions. And that was echoing the language from Americans United, where Americans United held that none of the provisions at issue there were unconstitutional. I mean, there were no violations because the aid was there to aid the student and not the institution. Weaver is also important because, Your Honor, it discusses how Supreme Court jurisprudence has been substantially modified, in its words, from 1982 and prior, back to Lemon in the 1970s, of course, and then from 1982 when the Americans United Court was relying upon First Amendment precedent through till now. And it says that in that substantial modification, we've gone from a place where investigations about pervasive sectarian and indoctrination of K-12 students are now of no constitutional relevance, because the relevant inquiry is, has the government engaged in something that is endorsing religion, or has the government shown neutrality? And what the Colorado courts have said time and again, not only Americans United, is it's not just a neutrality, it's a benevolent neutrality towards religion. And so, again, Weaver is relevant because Weaver draws together not just the Lemon cases and Mitchell cases and others, but it draws them together all discussing how if an indoctrination analysis is done, it not only entangles courts, but it also prefers certain religious bodies over others. It prefers the mildly religious bodies that don't indoctrinate over the pervasively religious bodies that do indoctrinate.
So would, if Douglas County had said, we want only non-sectarian schools in our program, would that have been constitutional under your view?
Yes. Douglas County could have made that choice, but it also constitutionally could make the choice it did make, which is it's going to open this program to any schools, all schools, religious or non-religious, so long as they satisfy the 12 criteria of eligibility. And those criteria are all secular in nature, and they all go towards assuring that the education that the choice program students receive is a quality education. Again, the very first eligibility criteria talks about how the schools must be able to demonstrate that student performance, achievement, and growth is at least as good or better than the district's other schools. The eligibility criteria mandate that the program students must be able to take assessments like CSAPs and TCAPs, whatever assessments the district wants, so that the district can compare apples to apples whether the students are progressing well in the choice program as in the other schools. The district has the authority under the program to terminate a school if it's not showing growth. The district has the authority to give contracts that vary in length from 1 to 5 years to ensure all of these things are going towards ensuring that any students are receiving a quality education at a private school. But then anything beyond that, again, the extra math and science, extra music and art, religion courses, those are all choices made by the parents. and therefore any decision about money flowing to religious organizations are attributable to the parents. That's what the United States Supreme Court said in Zelman versus Simmons-Harris. Again, the 2002 case dealing with the Ohio program that's extremely similar to this one. And we believe that this court should look to the Zelman case and look there that in Zelman, applying, again, constitutional analysis, including analysis growing out of Lemon, that in Zelman, any thought of how indoctrinating K-12 schools are is not even discussed. It's not even relevant. What's relevant is this a neutral program of genuine private choice? And there's no dispute that the Douglas County program is a neutral program of genuine private choice. In Zelman, for instance, it discusses if there is some sort of incidental benefit that religious schools receive because they're participating in this program, that those incidental benefits are attributable to the parents, not to the government. And frankly, Your Honors, that's the same language that Americans United used back in 1982. In 1982, it said, when money is being sent to parents and students, and then they're making the decisions about where the money should be spent, that is incidental, so incidental and remote as not to be a constitutional violation. It's a mere byproduct, and therefore not a constitutional violation. Or said differently, it is not in aid of, to pick up the language of Article 9, Section 7, the no aid clause, it's not in aid of the religious institutions. It's in aid of the students and families. And that's what the trial court held here as well. I will point out that in the state's briefing, the state listed 22 different programs, 17 of which have money going to religious schools. 22 of those programs are, again, public-private partnerships, as we describe them, where, again, districts and preschools and higher education, all throughout Colorado education, from top to bottom, public funds can and do flow to religious and private organizations.
Mr. Hall, how does that affect our analysis, though? I mean, that just might mean there are a bunch of unconstitutional programs. I mean, how does the fact that these programs exist affect the constitutional analysis of this program?
These programs have been enacted by our legislature year after year after year. And our position is they've been enacted because the lawyers analyzing them recognize that, again, Americans United means what it says. And frankly, plaintiff's position is just mistaken, that in fact, districts can and do spend money on private institutions all the time. I mean, the contract school statute is one that's been disputed here, but the contract school statute enacted in 1993 couldn't be clearer. That the legislature there said school districts may purchase educational services from private schools. And the testimony at the hearing from Senator Keith King, from Commissioner Hammond, were that that's what many districts do. The district that Senator King talked about was DPS, Denver Public Schools. They have contract schools they purchase services from.
That's not the question. The question is, okay, they do it. That doesn't mean they can do it under the Constitution. And that's the fact that they do it is not legal authority for the proposition that they can constitutionally do it. I mean, it seems this whole argument seems to me to be, frankly, some kind of, oh, look what's going to happen if you strike this program down. We'll be striking down programs left and right. But as judges, that's not supposed to enter our thinking. We have to deal with the program that's here before the court and decide whether it's constitutional and let the cards, you know, fall where they, you know, fall where they may. That's just how it is. We don't get to say, oh, gee, that would be a bad result from a policy standpoint, so we're just going to ignore the Constitution.
I agree with that, Your Honor, except it should be relevant to this court's determination when it looks out at statutes, again, passed for decades and says, well, no one's offered these sorts of arguments until now with plaintiffs. So it should at least give the court pause, if not, again, a factor into the analysis of how these programs are in fact constitutional. But let me give you a case, Your Honor. I mean, one of the propositions, again, issued by plaintiffs is that under the school system clause, Article 9, Section 2, monies can only be spent on public schools, right? No, only free public schools are allowed to be created. Well, that was decided against plaintiffs way back in 1893 in the Inouye kindergarten case. Again, the Article 9, Section 2 says there must be a system of free public schools for students ages 6 to 21. Well, way back in 1893, someone wanted to have kindergarten, and kindergartners are sometimes 5 years old, and someone sued, saying you can't do that. And the College Supreme Court said, no, the fact that there's a requirement on the General Assembly to provide free public schooling for students aged 6 to 21 does not mean that districts cannot provide more than that, does not mean that there is a prohibition on saying you can't do more than what's constitutionally required. Again, what plaintiffs continue to confuse is a ceiling and a floor. What we have is a constitutional floor and statutory floor that certain things must be done, but that doesn't prohibit Douglas County from doing more than that. And Douglas County has chosen to do more than that. No one's requiring it to, but it has said, as a school district charged with the responsibility for educating our students, this is what we want to do.
Counselor, do you intend to argue the Blaine argument today?
Not unless you ask me about it.
All right, well, I'm going to ask you about it. What I'm wondering, because I didn't see it in your briefs, was is there any legal authority for the proposition that a court can strike down as unconstitutional, I presume under the federal constitution, a state constitutional provision because the perceived motives of some of those who may have backed it were impure? Is there any case ever doing that?
Yes, Your Honor.
What case is that?
It's at the end of our briefs. Let's see, the name escapes me right now. It's out of Alabama, but it dealt with racial discrimination. And I can look it up, and I'll come back on rebuttal and tell you what the name is. But it talked about it. In the Jim Crow days, there were provisions that were unconstitutional in their intent and then acted upon, and under equal protection, that case allowed for it to be struck down. But Your Honor, I mean, that's the case, and I'll give you the name of it in a second. But the Blaine Amendment is important because what plaintiffs are asking this court to do is, again, take, frankly, a position of absolute separation, a very hard position on how the language is written. Well, if you're going to do that, then you have to consider what these words mean very carefully, including looking at their legislative history. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttals.
You have 7 minutes and 30 seconds, Mr. Hall.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
May it please the court. My name is Matt Douglas, and I, along with Michael McCarthy and Michelle Albert, represent the plaintiffs in this case. I represent the LaRue plaintiffs, and given the number and complexity of the issues in this case, the taxpayer plaintiffs and the LaRue plaintiffs divided up the issues in our brief, and we're going to similarly divide the argument along those lines. I'm going to address the religion clauses in the Colorado Constitution, and my co-counsel, Mr. McCarthy, is going to address the public school funding and related issues, and also the standing issue. I will reserve it, or I'll take 15 minutes of my time for Mr. McCarthy, but my attorney registration number is 26017. This case is about a program enacted by the Douglas County School District that in a number of different ways violates the specific prohibitions of the Colorado Constitution. We have a largely undisputed factual record that supports the trial court's ruling about those violations. I do want to stress that each of those separate constitutional violations in itself provides a basis to enjoin this program. So in order for the appellants to prevail, they have to convince this court that the trial court was wrong on every single one of those violations. And how do they say the trial court got it wrong? You heard a lot about this from Mr. Hall. Fundamentally, they say that choice, the fundamental right of parental choice of education, trumps everything, including the Colorado Constitution, but there's simply no basis for that. And I want to make clear at the outset that none of the plaintiffs in this case disputes the right of parents to send their children to whatever school they choose, religious or otherwise. but there is no fundamental right to have the state and its taxpayers fund all of those choices. And the Colorado Constitution specifically prohibits public funding of religious education. Appellants provide no authority that this parental choice allows you to ignore the specific prohibitions in the Colorado Constitution. And this choice and experimentation you heard discussed by Mr. Hall, nothing in the Owens case and nothing in the Colorado Constitution or statute says that that type of experimentation isn't subject to the other prohibitions of the Colorado Constitution. Charter schools are one form of experimentation that was discussed in the Owens case and by the appellants in this case. Charter schools, public charter schools of the state, must still comply with the Colorado Constitution, including Article 9, Section 7, and Article 2, Section 8. That doesn't get you around these prohibitions. Now, this and the other very serious barriers in the Colorado Constitution were well known to the district and the state defendants when they were designing this program. And you can see how serious the problems are when you look at some of the things that they tried to do to get around the plain language of the Colorado Constitution and statutes. They designed a sham charter school so they could count the public school students to get the state money, the per pupil funding for public schools. But the charter school doesn't exist. There's no building, there's no classrooms, there's no teachers, there's no textbooks. They also decided to write the voucher checks out in the names of the parents so they could try to say that the money's not really aiding the schools, not really going to the schools, it's going to the parents. But they mail the checks to the parents, and the parents can only restrictively endorse them over to the schools.
Mr. Douglas, isn't this program facially neutral?
Your Honor, the facially neutral argument, legally and factually, I don't agree with that. It specifically allows for religious discrimination by the schools, and it was specifically tailored to get the participation of the religious schools.
But on its face, it's neutral. And if it's neutral, can the court inquire about the degree of religious beliefs?
I don't believe the court needs to inquire about the extent of religious beliefs in order to find that it violates Article 9, Section 7. Article 9, Section 7 doesn't prohibit only aid to pervasively sectarian schools. It prohibits aid to any school controlled by a church or religious organization. So in order to answer that question, you don't need to get into how religious the schools are versus one or the other.
Didn't the court do exactly that? I mean, it was at one point in the order, the court said it wouldn't inquire into the pervasiveness, and then it went on for page after page doing so, and then expressly numerous times relied upon its findings regarding the pervasiveness of the indoctrination, as the court put it, for its holdings. And can the court constitutionally do that under current U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence?
The court can and do exactly what it did, and I can explain why. The Tenth Circuit's concern, the Tenth Circuit struck down, by the way, Mr. Hall said that the Tenth Circuit said that the Americans United opinion was no longer valid, but the only thing the Tenth Circuit did was strike down the pervasively sectarian criteria in the statute that was at issue in Americans United. And the basis for that was that analysis distinguished between different religions and different schools and treated them differently based on those distinctions. The trial court's order does none of that. It simply evaluates whether the Colorado constitutional provisions are violated. Now, in order to determine whether, for example, sectarian tenets are being taught at a school, you have to look at the school's curriculum. And that's one of the things that it did. And that's perfectly permissible. There's federal case law that consistently upholds that very type of analysis, and Colorado case law as well. I would point actually to the recent decision by Judge Bernard this year in the Freedom from Religion versus Hickenlooper case, where His Honor did a detailed analysis of whether the prayer proclamations, it was the Day of Prayer case, had to look at the text of those prayers, whether there was a secular purpose or a religious purpose, and whether the text of those prayers furthered the interests of religion or promoted a particular religion. That's a perfectly permissible inquiry.
But that was an inquiry under provision that's not at issue in this case.
I agree, it was different. Well, Article 2, Section 4 is an issue of a different clause.
But a different clause, yeah.
But in order for a court to undertake those types of analysis, for example, in the Bowman case, Bowman versus U.S., the ruling was that it was permissible for the federal government to exclude from military pension credit community service work that was done for religious organizations and work done for religious purposes. In order to undertake that analysis, you have to do some evaluation of the religiosity of whether it is a religious organization. Similarly here, to determine whether schools are incidentally related to a religious group or controlled and owned by a religious group, or whether, again, sectarian tenets are being taught, or whether there is a requirement of a religious oath. All those things are prohibited by the Colorado Constitution.
Mr. Douglas, as I understand this program, it doesn't compel students to attend religious services.
Well, almost all the schools in the program do. And the requirement of the program is that you are enrolled in this public charter school. So they want to say these are public school students in order to get the state money for public school students. Then they want to turn it around and have it both ways and say, oh, but these aren't public school students, so you can teach them religious tenets. But you can't have it both ways. So if these are public school students that are receiving state money that's earmarked for public school students, and they're attending a public charter school, they're subject to the same requirements of the Constitution as any other charter school student in the state.
But how is it compulsion? You still have the parents making the choice. They don't have to choose to participate in the program at all. They can simply opt for the public schools or one of many other options. Once they choose to participate in the program, they don't have to choose a religious school. The program does not require them to choose a religious school. The program, it seems to me, doesn't require anybody to do anything.
That doesn't get anyone around. Regular charter schools, all charter schools in the state are voluntary. No one has to go to those charter schools. No one has to send their children to those charter schools. They're still subject to the same constitutional requirements. So that doesn't get you around the Colorado Constitution.
Of course not, except that you're relying on provisions that expressly deal with compelled attendance and it uses that sort of language when there is no compelled attendance at any religious school here by the program. If anybody's compelling it, it's the parents.
Well, compelled attendance under Article 2, Section 4 is the language there, but not in Article 9, Section 8. There's nothing about it. It says no sectarian.
And I want to make sure we distinguish between these, because you're kind of, in your analysis and your argument, you're just throwing them all in there. And some of them talk about compelled attendance, for example. Some of them talk about aid to religious schools, a different issue, mm-hmm. for example. So let's make sure we draw those lines.
Absolutely. And when you talk about aid to the religious schools, there was an argument by Mr. Hall that that the trial court found that there was not aid, that this was not aid to the schools. And I want to read from page 42 of the trial court's decision. It says, any funds provided to the schools, even if strictly limited to the cost of education, will result in the impermissible aid to private school partners. That's a specific finding of the trial court.
Yeah, it was
aid to the
school. It was. And but my question about that is, would you agree, though, that regardless of whether, I don't want to get into this issue, whether the Colorado Constitution is different from the federal constitution in this regard, but that sort of analysis is different than Zelman. I mean, in Zelman, we had the same kind of program, and the court said that is not aid to religious organizations.
Yes, and Locke says that, like Zelman, the Establishment Clause only limits certain things. Certain things are permissible under the Establishment Clause that may be specifically prohibited by a state constitution, and that was the issue in Locke. And in Zelman, they only looked at the federal constitutional issues. They weren't looking at any state constitutional issues.
Right.
And found
Absolutely.
The program permissible because of the parental choice issue. There were also some factual differences in Zelman, in particular, the fact that Zelman, that program included public and private schools, and all of the schools in the program were not permitted to discriminate on the basis of religion, where here the schools can and do discriminate on the basis of religion in admissions.
Okay, but don't they have to, doesn't a neutral program, and it has to, if it's constitutional at all, it has to be neutral, religiously speaking, don't they have to allow religions to practice religion as they see fit? They can't say, oh, you can't enforce your religious beliefs if you want to participate in this program.
Well, when it rises to the level of discrimination on admission, then it's not open to the public, and they're only going to admit specific people with specific religious beliefs. That's when it takes away from choice, and that was different. In Zelman, they specifically precluded that the schools from doing that. Here, they don't, and the schools testified that, in fact, they do. They would try to steer people away who don't share their religious beliefs. And that's also one of the important points here, is that what's before this court is this particular program, and in this particular program, there was no real choice. At the high school level, there were zero non-religious schools, other than one very small school that only accepts a particular type of special needs student, Human X Academy. Outside of that, at the high school level, zero non-religious choice. So,
hey, Mr. Douglas, I would like to steer you back to something you said earlier. Mm-hmm. You made a comment that this program was specifically tailored to bring in religious schools. Could you explain that for me, please?
Yes. At the outset of the program, the district had an opt-out provision, which would allow students to opt out of both religious instruction, religious classes, and also attendance at mandatory religious services. And that's what they initially rolled out to the private schools. And the religious schools said, we're not going to participate if that's your opt-out. So they then tailored the opt-out and watered it down. And if you look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 91, Dr. Christian Cutter, assistant superintendent at the district, said that the reason that they watered down that opt-out provision was specifically to get the participation of the religious schools. And the opt-out provision, as it was filed in the program, said you cannot opt out of religious education. You have to do that. And you also have to attend the religious services. You can sit quietly as long as you don't call attention to the fact that you're sitting quietly.
Were any of the schools in the program recruited by any of the members of the school board or any of the members of the charter school?
The charter school, I don't know, but the school district did specifically solicit by email input from many of these religious schools. It was relating to the opt-out, whether they were going to participate in the program, and what it would take to get them to participate in the program. The promises, for example, to Cherry Hills Christian, that they would work with them on implementing the opt-out so that it was something they could live with. So there absolutely was interaction and the tailoring of the program so that they could try to get the participation of the religious schools. Now, on the blame issue that Your Honor mentioned, the case that I believe Mr. Hall is referring to is the Hunter versus Underwood case, 471 U.S. 222, which is very different here than what we have here, because in that case, there was evidence that the provision in question was specifically enacted to discriminate against a specific targeted group. And there was evidence that there was an ongoing effect that continued to be applied in a way that discriminated against those targeted groups. Here, you have a provision that prohibits funding of schools controlled by any church or sectarian denomination whatsoever, any church. It does not separate out Catholics. It does not, on its face, discriminate against Catholics or any particular religion. And as applied, the trial court's order does not distinguish among or between schools, treats them all equally, says that if you're a school controlled by any church of any kind, you can't receive the state public money, which is what the Constitution says. So there's simply no discrimination on either end, on the enactment or on the effect. And there was a very thin and contradictory factual record in this case that the trial court found failed to make any real connection between the Blaine Amendment and what was going on the East Coast and the Colorado framing of the Constitution.
There's a debate about that in the literature, right?
And that's what the trial court found. There's a dispute in the literature, there's a dispute in the evidence, and there's no clear connection between what was going on there and what was going on in Colorado. So I'm going to turn it over to my co-counsel, Mr. McCarthy, with my remaining time. Thank you. May it please the court. Michael McCarthy, registration number 6688, appearing on behalf of the Appalese Taxpayers for Public Education and the Barnes. The core point that we have to bring before the court with respect to the public school finance issues, and those are the issues that were presented to the trial court under Article 9, Sections 2, 3, 15, and the Public School Finance Act, 2254-101 at SEEK. The core point, Your Honor, that we have to make under the Public School Finance Act piece of this case is that read together, the constitutional and statutory provisions relating to public school finance, read together, had a purpose and intent to prevent depletion of public school finance resources. This program, as we showed through the trial court, if allowed to proceed, will gut public school finance in this state. It will do so because, as the record established, as Mr. Carson testified at trial, this program is only the beginning. Douglas County, if allowed to proceed with this program, 500 students, $2 million. If allowed to proceed, they will grow the program. They will grow the program, Your Honor, to limits that, with unless stopped, will operate to materially deplete the financing available to public schools. And what we submit is that read together 2, 3, 15 of Article 9 of the Public School Finance Act create a broad mandate that public education in Colorado shall be free, thorough and uniform, controlled by local school districts, and that public funds, especially from the Public School Lands Fund, shall not be diverted to private or other non-public institutions. And the purpose for preventing that depletion is to not let the choice value that the appellants would make preeminent, not to let that choice leave other children behind who don't have the resources to make a choice to go to schools whose tuition is much greater in almost every instance, as we showed in this program, than the $4,500 that would be provided through the Choice Scholarship Program.
Mr. McCarthy.
Yes, sir.
If we allow standing in private citizens on this issue of public school finance, aren't we really allowing them to be substitute boards of education?
No, I would submit not. And it's standing is a question that I would respectfully submit is a case-by-case analysis that's framed by the specific issues presented by the facts that are brought before the court. But more broadly, though, Your Honor, I think that the answer to your question in terms of standing is predicated on the test that Justice Rivera set forth in his opinion, Dodge against the Department of Social Services at 600 P. Second, 1979. That basic test is, did the plaintiff incur an injury in fact, and if so, was it to a legally protected interest encompassed by statutory or constitutional provisions? So the ad verendum argument about citizens substituting for school boards has to be answered in terms of what did this school board do here? And what the school board did was it took action in collaboration with the Department of Education, which was supposed to be the watchdog for this kind of behavior. They took action that would directly impact and cause an injury in fact to my clients and their legally protected interest under the Public School Finance Act. And what they have is a legally protected interest to assure that the finance formula that's announced in 2254-101 is applied.
But the Public School Finance Act doesn't name them as protected parties in the least.
Absolutely, Ron. That's completely correct. However, many statutes that the appellate courts in Colorado have found to be enforceable, not by way of a damages action, you know, that sort of inferring a 10b-5 claim of action, but rather by injunctive relief and declaratory relief, which is what we saw here. Many, many statutes. The statutes that were involved in the Dodge case, there was no express cause of action granted in those statutes. And that's why Justice Rivera said, what you need to do when you have to look at the question of standing, is you look at the facts that are before you. I think as Judge Jones said, we adjudicate these cases case by case, fact by fact. And what we showed to the trial court here was that our clients would suffer an injury in fact because it wasn't indirect, it
wasn't incidental. It was $2 million. It was $2 million going out the door. It was 500 students going out the door. Not to any kind of public institution. Every one of those students was going to go to a private institution. And every penny of that money was going to go directly or through the charter school, which was an artifice to channel this money, was going to go to private institutions.
Well, Mr. McCarthy, what evidence in the record is there that those students would not have otherwise attended a Douglas County public school if this program were not available?
Your Honor, that evidence can only be inferred.
Well, it sounds like you're saying
it's explicit evidence. Did we question a student that chose to do this and say, if you were able to do this, would you still have gone to Douglas County? The answer to your question is no.
All right, so there's no evidence. And the court made a finding that money would be diverted, and I'm looking through the record for some evidence of that, and you're just telling me there isn't any. You just said there isn't any. So in other words, if this program didn't exist, there's no evidence in the record to show that these 500 students, assuming maximum participation in the program, they would have been in Douglas County schools. They would have been getting the per pupil revenue for those 500 students anyway. So how is it being diverted away from other districts? They would have gotten the money anyway.
Your Honor, the $2 million would have stayed, and I want to make sure that I understand your question. First of all, in terms of the question of would they have still gone to Douglas County schools anyway, the answer to that is they all had to be going there in the first place to participate in the program. So I think there's a logical inference that they would have continued their attendance in Douglas County schools. But the mischief here, Your Honor, is that by leaving the school district, they were able to take with them $2 million. That $2 million, I mean, in those simplest terms, it shouldn't have gone with them. If they wanted to go to a private school, they were perfectly willing to do that, but they shouldn't have been able to take $2 million along with them.
That sounds to me like it's a question of whether it violates, say, the no aid provision that we talked about before. But the court seems to have accepted the argument that this money was being diverted from other school districts to the Douglas County districts and then to private schools. But that's only true if the money would not have gone to the Douglas County schools anyway. But it would have.
This is, I think, somewhat of a confusing piece of the record before, because the monies that were subject to this program were going to be divided 75-25%.
Right.
25% was going to be retained by a charter school. 75% was going to be moved directly into the pockets of the private schools that participated in this. Narrowly, Your Honor, what the trial court held was that the 25% that was kept in the charter school improperly, I'll use the word colloquially, enriched the Douglas County School District, because that money was allowed to be retained even though the students had left.
Now, but here's the problem with that. They're enriched, as you say, only if they wouldn't have gotten the money anyway. And I'm looking for something in the record that says they wouldn't have, and you seem to be conceding the Douglas County School District would have gotten every penny of that money anyway. In other words, we don't have this program. They still have these 500 students in the public schools of Douglas County. They get all the per pupil revenue for those students, and so they have 100% of that money. It's not being diverted from any other district.
But they have 100%? I feel that I'm not answering your question.
I think you are.
They have 100% of the money only if the program isn't implemented. And it is. And once the program is implemented, the money's gone. And to just move to an even more specific substantive issue, specifically in terms of Article 9, Section 3, the public lands funds, there's a variable thicket, a hash of line drawing that goes on in the First Amendment jurisprudence that is being argued before this court. The one piece of this case I would respectfully submit as to which there couldn't be a brighter line is Article 9, Section 3, as to the public lands fund monies. The title of that section of the Constitution says it all. The title of that section is Public mayor's fund, I'm going to make sure I get it right, public school funding violation. That is the constitutional title for the section and the case law, and the plain meaning of the statute provides that the public school fund, quote, only shall be expended in the maintenance of the schools of the state. This money was not being expended in the maintenance of schools of the state. It was being expended in the maintenance of the private schools that signed up for this program. There's no de minimis exception to this provision in the Colorado Constitution, and the de minimis exception wouldn't apply here, I would submit, in any event, because the total amount of money here was $110 million that was being generated in the years that we're discussing from that public lands trust fund. And nor can this money be seen as somehow artificially segregated. What we see in some of the arguments that's made, that are made in the state's briefing, is that the court should look to private trust law and somehow post hoc impose a segregation so that the infected funds don't contaminate the uninfected funds.
So public funds can never be used for any charter schools.
I'm sorry, the second
part. Public funds can never be used for any charter schools.
No, the charter, actually, Your Honor, charter schools under the statute are public schools. So the public lands funds.
But your argument here is this isn't a charter school.
It's not a charter school, Your Honor. It's not a charter school because a charter school by definition can't be religious. This charter school is created for the administration of a population of schools that are predominantly religious. So the terms of the Public School Finance Act, which mandate a charter school be non-religious, are violated. And it's a bright line that says these monies cannot go to fund private schools has been crossed. And having crossed it, they cannot recover this program. Much of what the court heard in the appellant's argument was the refrain of choice, choice, choice. Well, first of all, as we said to the trial court, choice isn't the preeminent constitutional value in this case or in this state. But what choice doesn't do is it doesn't speak at all to the public school finance issues. It provides no immunity, it provides no shield to the violation of Article 9, Section 3. And it provides no shield to the violation of the Public School Finance Act, which requires that a specific funding formula be used and be implemented statewide. And what Judge Martinez found was that that formula was violated by the 25% that was retained by a charter school that didn't go to the benefit of the public school. And we submit, going beyond what the trial court found, was that the 75% is an illegal transfer in violation of Article 9, Sections 2, 3, and 15, because this is not a free public education, because it's not thorough and uniform education, notwithstanding Owens. It's not thorough and uniform, and because it is not subject to local control, because the school board here has abdicated its responsibility to the private schools.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy.
I do have one question. I wanted to ask you the same procedural question I'd asked opposing counsel, whether you agree that we do have a final disposition of all claims in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. We agree that it is a final disposition, and actually there was a specific, you may have noticed it in the record, there was a specific colloquy on the record between Judge Martinez and me and Mr. Lyons during the course of the trial and counsel for the LaRue parties as well, where Judge Martinez, said, is there anything else to do? Is there anything else to decide? And I think all the parties said, no, they're not. And so under Rule 65, the trial court had the authority to combine the preliminary and the permanent stages. And there was no objection. There was no objection in the immediate aftermath. And I do believe we're properly before you, Your Honor, on a final order.
Just want to make sure. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just to start with a point of clarification, the trial court found in favor of the defendants on the Article 9, Section 2 claim and on the Article 9, Section 15 claim. So I thought Mr. McCarthy might have misstated that, but just so that we're clear, trial court found there was no violation of 9.2 or 9.15. As to 9.3, the school land trust, I would direct the court to the Brotman case, Brotman versus East Lake Creek Ranch, to the Branson case, Branson School District versus Romer. Both of those cases go on at some length. Brotman is a 2001 Colorado Supreme Court case. Branson is a 1998 Tenth Circuit case. Both go on at length about how 9.3 creates a trust. It creates a trust which prevents the state of Colorado from spending the school lands or the interest on the school lands on anything else, like highways or water projects, other things. What that says is that beneficiaries of that trust are the school districts, which is, again, consistent with the idea of local control in Colorado. So once that money from 9.3 is given to the school districts, then that trust obligation has been discharged, and the districts can spend it as they would like. Even the one case that Appellees cite, the Craig case, which is, I think, in 1931, quite an old case, even that case says once the money is given to the districts, it vests in the districts. That's the language of that case, consistent with all the other cases we've had. So there is no violation of 9.3. Again, even if it could be thought that that's 2% interest money must be maintained by the district, it is maintained as part of the 25% hold. Just to follow up on one point, again, you all pressed Mr. McCarthy about, well, if his argument is correct about if you, either under 9.3 or when you read it all together, public funds can only be spent on public schools, that means public school districts can't spend money at any private institution. They can't buy janitorial services at a private, they can't buy buses from a private company. They can't pay their private lawyers at private law firms. I mean, school districts exist in the commercial world, the public-private world. School districts all the time spend money on private entities. And again, the contract school statute says that also public schools can spend money on private schools to provide contracts and services. So,
Mr. Hall, I noticed, though, that that particular statute, the contracting statute, has been amended very recently, I believe this year. It used to provide that money could be spent on any service, and now it says maybe spent on a service. Were you aware of that amendment?
I was not aware of that amendment. My most recent review of that statute, again, as I read it, is that it's unambiguous, and I think even Appellees concede that it's not in their papers. They don't argue it's ambiguous. And that it can be spent to buy services at a private school. So again, we point to that statute as just one of, again, 22 where districts can and do buy services from private organizations, on private educational organizations, but also they buy services more than that. So they buy services from private entities.
Well, Mr. Hall, I want to get to something Mr. McCarthy talked about, which is this charter school.
Yes.
And of course, it's referred to as the sham charter school.
The sham
charter school. Well, there isn't a building. There aren't any teachers. There's no curriculum. In what sense is it a school?
It was used as the district, by the district, as an administrative convenience. We've always said that. It was used in order to count the students, to count them for public finance purposes, and also to administer the program so that we could ensure that the private schools were carrying out their duties. This is a district program, and it's allowed to create the necessary conveniences to operate the program.
And as I understand the record, though, the State Department of Education has not yet, and maybe they're kind of in a state of limbo here, but they haven't yet made a determination as to whether it will indeed count students.
Correct.
That are enrolled, technically speaking, in that charter school. Is that right?
Correct. That was the testimony. And these allusions by Appellees to collusion, I mean, but the state of Colorado had made no definitive decisions. Yes, they met with Douglas County on two occasions informally, but the testimony was clear that they have not decided whether these students would in fact count. Now, I do want to touch on this idea of $2 million leaving the district.
Before we leave that, Mr. Hall, if I may, please.
Please.
If it's not a school, why call it one? Why not just say that there's an administrative office over here and this officer has this obligation?
Sure.
Because when you start calling it a school, doesn't that suggest that there are other things going on?
Well, if you read the policy itself, you'll see it refers to just the choice program office. I didn't talk to in sort of school, but the testimony, the superintendent testified about that. And she said, yeah, we chose a choice school as a platform. We didn't have to, but we chose it just because it accelerated the waiver process. You can get waivers from state statutes if you, and it goes more quickly if you use a charter school. So
there is a school related purpose for the non-existent school.
Sure. I mean, it was used as in order to facilitate this program. But again, there's nothing wrong or nefarious about that. The relevant inquiry about the amount of money is the net result. What Appellees refuse to acknowledge is the testimony is uncontested that the net result is that the district would benefit in the amount of $350,000 because their expenses went down and yet they retained 25% of the money. So the net result in Douglas County was benefited. So again, there's no injury in fact, if we want to touch on the standing argument with that. The Dodge case, that's a taxpayer standing case. Frankly, all the cases they cite are taxpayer standing cases. There is no case that allows parents or taxpayers to bring a claim under the Finance Act. If I may, to refer back to Mr. Judge Jones, yes, Hunter versus Underwood is the case in our briefing, and also we refer you to Romer versus Evans, both places where the legislative history about how constitutional amendments were enacted were relevant. I wouldn't want to discuss that any further unless you have questions.
I'm more familiar with the Romer case, but in those cases, doesn't the court look to whether there is any objectively reasonable explanation or intent that would support the provision? That is, they don't really delve too deeply into the subjective intent of certain people who may have been for or against a particular provision. They do a more objective analysis under equal protection. Is there any rational basis here? Can we conceive of, objectively speaking, of a rational basis? Isn't that the analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. And then, given the time, just refer you to those cases. But I just say that I don't think we even need to get to that issue, because we think our position is Americans United and Weaver decide this case. You only need to look to Americans United, which says very clearly this sort of program is permissible because it's a neutral program of genuine private choice. And the Weaver case discusses how, under current First Amendment law, and not the old, now discovered First Amendment law that Americans United relied on in part, under current First Amendment law, these indoctrination analyses the trial court went into are unconstitutional. They excessively entangle, in this case, the trial court in this sort of analysis. So unless you have any other questions, I see I'm out of time.
Thank you again, Mr. Hall.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy, Douglas. Counsel's arguments were excellent today, and they were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That